from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, a tentative deal has apparently been brokered between the White House and Republican congressional leadership to extend the soon-to-expire Bush tax cuts. We'll find out all about the proposed compromise in the hour ahead and what the details are, as well as what kinds of economic effects are likely to result. That's next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. A deal apparently has been worked out between President Obama and Republicans to extend the Bush tax cuts for 2 years to all Americans, including the mostly wealthy. And that's in exchange for a renewal of extending another 13 months of the jobless benefits, which recently had expired for millions of Americans. Other reported details of the deal include a temporary 2% one-year payroll tax reduction and a compromise on the estate tax to be set for 2 years at 35% with a $5 million exemption. And in addition, a tax rate for capital gains and dividends maintained at 15%. In this morning's opening forum hour, we want to focus on the tentative deal and on what it means for the economy. Joining us from Washington is Chris Edwards. He directs tax policy studies for the Cato Institute. And good morning, Chris Edwards.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Dean Baker, who is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research and is also author of Plunder and Blunder, The Rise and Fall of the Bubble Economy. Welcome, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on.
Glad to have you. And with us also this morning is Ari Berman, who is contributing writer to Nation Magazine, author of Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. Welcome, Ari Berman.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And let me begin, if I may, with you, Ari Berman. This is being called unconscionable because the 2% most affluent are getting tax breaks, and unconscionable by Dick Durbin of Illinois. It seems to many like President Obama caved in here, but by the same token, people are defending this as a compromise that had to be made in order to get these unemployment benefits extended.
Yeah, well, the White House is definitely spinning it as not as bad as it was portrayed to be. But I do think if you look at Obama's rhetoric during the presidential campaign, I mean, one of his closing arguments was that we should not be giving tax breaks to millionaires and billionaires. And he really ridiculed the idea that if you gave that money, that it would just trickle down and benefit the hundreds of thousands of people who don't have jobs. And so he did reverse on that platform. There's an interesting poll that just came out that I saw that showed that Obama's base really, really doesn't like this. People who contributed to Obama, for example, 74% oppose the deal, 57% say they're less likely to support Democrats who back it, and 51% said they're less likely to contribute to Obama in 2012 because of this. So there's no doubt a lot of unease among the base right now because of this deal.
Now, the president also is being criticized for a lack of political will or for an inability to make tough necessary decisions.
Absolutely. And I think that's the other really core thing is I think, you know, maybe this was inevitable, but I think that people didn't see him fighting. It was kind of like the debate over the public option health care reform. Obama said he wanted it, but he expended no political capital to actually get it. And I think that's what was frustrating to everyone is Democrats had the majority. They had big majorities. They had the White House. They could have really pushed hard and put Republicans on the spot before the election and said, okay, vote on these middle class tax cuts. We all agree on them. And that's the consensus position. But instead, he kept leaving the door open for a plan that Republicans would like more, which then, of course, did not incentivize Republicans to vote with Democrats when the time came.
Dean Baker, you don't see this as so catastrophic to the economy. In fact, you see it as maybe even a stimulus, despite the fact that when you look at the breakdown of $60 billion and how it could have been used for infrastructure, for maybe sending more troops to Afghanistan, for universal preschool, I mean, so many things that have been enumerated. But it doesn't necessarily, in your judgment, hurt the economy that badly?
Well,
it actually, in the short term, helps. I mean, it's not the point here is we need to spend money, and this is something I wish President Obama would have made more clear, is that we lost on the order of $1.2 trillion in demand from the private sector with the collapse of the housing bubble, and there's nothing to replace that. There is only the government sector that could fill in that hole. And we did that to some extent with the stimulus, but when you look at how much was spent on an annual basis, you pull out money spent later in a technical tax fix, and you get about $300 billion a year, and roughly half of that was offset by cutbacks from the state and local sector. So the stimulus, for all it's being touted as huge and gigantic and everything, is about $150 billion a year in net stimulus from the public sector. So we need to spend more money, and the, you know, the tax breaks for rich people, that's just about the worst way you could do it, but they will spend some of it. So, you know, other things equal, you know, if you have them spending a little bit of that money over the next 2 years, 2011 and 2012, that's a positive. Now, down the road, we are going to need more tax revenue, and it makes more sense to get it from the wealthy than take it from middle class or moderate income people. So in that sense, there will be a very big political and economic issue down the road. It was, I think, unfortunate that President Obama didn't take it to a head. But, you know, I'm not too troubled about spending another $50 billion a year on tax cuts for the wealthy right now in terms of its economic impact.
I think you also pointed out in one of the articles that you wrote that a temporary extension of this makes it more difficult in terms of getting, well, getting the rich to be taxed later on.
Yeah, I mean, it's you had at this point, you still had Democratic control of both houses of Congress. I mean, the Republicans obviously won the House come January, but the Democrats at this moment still control it. They still control the Senate. You have a Democrat in the White House. And if they're not able to end the tax cuts now, it certainly, you know, doesn't seem they'll be easier, say, 2 years from now when this extension expires. So it kicks the can down the road, but it does it in a way that's not that does not increase the likelihood of taking back those tax cuts at a point when we actually will need the revenue.
Chris Edwards of Cato, let's talk to you about this. It would appear that tax cuts to the rich doesn't quite make President Obama the socialist as many on the right have been trying to portray him, but it also seems to reinforce the idea that, well, trickle-down economics works, the old Margaret Thatcher notion at least.
I suspect that the president listened to some of his economists who told him that increasing taxes on anyone right now would be bad for the economy, and ultimately he knows his success is partly tied to how well the economy is doing. You know, to politely disagree with Dean, I mean, we don't need more spending now. Spending this year, federal spending is 25% of GDP. And to put that number in context, the last 2 years of President Clinton, spending was just 18% of GDP. So we've seen a huge increase in all kinds of spending. Entitlement spending, defense spending, domestic spending. We've had deficits of over $1 trillion 3 years in a row. And from a sort of a Keynesian economic point of view, that means we've had, you know, this enormous stimulus of over $1 trillion a year the last 3 years. And we can see that it hasn't really helped the economy. We've got unemployment still up around 10% or so. So I hope President Obama's compromise on this shows that he is willing to listen to different ideas in the months ahead. And, you know, his fiscal commission, which reported a couple of weeks ago, has some good tax reform ideas in there that I hope he thinks about and can maybe get some sort of a reform deal on taxes in the year or two ahead with Republicans to really get the economy moving.
But I was just reading also your fellow Cato Institute, colleague Doug Bardo, who said that the top 1% pays 40%, therefore they deserve tax cuts. But the public reacts very strongly to this. There's a freeze on federal salaries, but tax cuts for the rich and the very rich?
Let me put this into put that into perspective. The top federal income tax rate is now 35% this year, and so President Obama and Republicans have just agreed to extend that 35% tax rate. Back in 1986, the last major tax reform, President Reagan got together with Democrats Dick Gephardt and Bill Bradley in Congress, and they came up with a bipartisan tax reform deal that dropped the tax rate on the highest income people to just 28%. So we were at 28% in the late 80s. It's now 35%. And, you know, some Democrats are saying they want to push that rate to 40%. That makes no sense to me at all.
You've also said, Chris Edwards, that the unemployment benefits are bad policy. They're going to hurt the Democrats? Why?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think extending unemployment benefits will increase the unemployment rate. So it's ironic that the Democrats are pursuing this policy that I think will ultimately hurt them at the polls because it'll keep the unemployment rate artificially high.
And again, Chris Edwards is Director of Tech Policy Studies for the Cato Institute. Dean Baker is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. And Dean Baker, even with an extension of unemployment, you got 4 million who are set to lose benefits over the next year. And according to the Council of Economic Advisors, this will maybe curb spending, but it'll impede an already weak economy.
Well, that's right. And again, this gets back to the point. We need spending right now. One of the reasons why, you know, as Chris was saying, we've had an increase in the ratio of government spending GDP, that's because GDP is down by 10 percentage points. So when your denominator falls, guess what? Your fraction rises. So that's a big reason, one of the main reasons why we're spending more relative to the size of the economy. The idea that that unemployment benefits are increasing unemployment, I mean, we have five unemployed workers for every job opening. And there's actually a fair bit of research on this because we could look at what happened as we extended benefits. And if we think that people were just delaying getting a job because they go, oh, I can now get my benefits for, you know, 52 weeks rather than 26 or 72 weeks, there would have been a reduction in the percentage of people that were getting jobs as they were approaching those limits. You don't find that. So it doesn't fit the data. Also, Chris, I must have forgotten the 90s. We had tax rates of 39.6% and very rapid growth in that period. So this idea that somehow if we went back to the Clinton-era tax rates, that the economy would go through the floor. I should point out, by the way, of course, in the 60s, the tax rate was 70%. So, you know, clearly we could have strong economic growth with considerably higher tax rates than President Obama and the Democrats in Congress were talking about.
What about the deficit in all this? How do you see that, Dean Baker?
Well, it's really a non-issue right now. And, you know, we've had a lot of people running around like, crying wolf, making up all sorts of stories. They think we're Greece. They think we're Ireland. You know, there's a lot of differences between Greece and Ireland, among other things. We're a huge, diversified economy. Probably most importantly, we have our own currency. So the story they're saying, the bond market vigilantes, it literally is impossible. Because what would happen if we were ever in the situation of Greece, no one was going to buy our debt. The Federal Reserve Board, we could print our own. Now, that could lead to some inflation. But inflation doesn't just go through the roof. So even the worst case scenario is nothing like what they've described. And I just think it's incredibly dishonest. So in the short term, we have no deficit problem. In the longer term, when we get out 10, 15 years, we project to have a deficit problem, but that's because of our healthcare system. We currently spend two times as much per person as people in Germany, Canada, other countries, all of which have longer life expectancies than us. That's projected to rise to 3 and 4 times as much. If that really happens, it's going to devastate our economy, and it does give us a budget problem because we pay for more than half our health care through programs like Medicare and Medicaid. But it's really misleading to call that a deficit problem. That's a health care problem. Let's talk about fixing the health care system.
All right, Berman, let's go back to your political view on this, because certainly there's been strong language and rhetoric about President Obama surrendering no tax cuts for the rich was pretty much a mantra that we were hearing, and the Democrats were building a whole policy around opposing the Bush tax cuts. And now Paul Krugman said they've given in to blackmail and all they can do is move ahead on this score. But move ahead where?
Well, that's what's interesting. I mean, I think in the short term, they're going to try to sell this plan. And even some of those pundits, even Krugman, for example, is saying, well, maybe it's not as bad as I thought. He said it was a disappointment, but he said it was less bitter than he expected. So maybe expectations were so low for this that there was a little bit more stimulus in terms of how the tax cuts were done. People will be happier with them. I'm not sure where the White House goes from here. I mean, I think this mantra of Obama becoming weak and unprincipled is starting to get some traction. He does not really look like a bold, effective leader at the moment. And so I think he's going to have to give Democrats and his base something else in return for this, because I think there is going to be a lot of unrest about this plan. I don't know if that means, for example, getting Don't Ask, Don't Tell repealed in this lame duck session or doing it in the new Congress or something that was a major priority for his supporters, because I think what's going on now is there's just more and more unease. You're starting to hear more talk of a primary challenge in 2012. I don't think that's a good idea. I don't think it's going to happen. But nonetheless, that chatter is out there, and it's only growing right now.
All right, Berman, again, is contributing writer to The Nation magazine and author of Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. And Chris Edwards is director of tax policy studies with the Cato Institute. And Chris Edwards, I mean, you're pretty much cheered by this unified Republican front and see this as, a real positive in terms of maybe the budget focus now being on what you alluded to before of spending cuts.
Well, that's right. I mean, I disagree with Dean that, I think that the deficit is a gigantic problem, and I think the problem is spending. If you look at President Obama's budget, he's got debt rising throughout the 10-year projection period, and in a lot of ways, his budget is really optimistic. So I think when debt gets up to about 100% of GDP, that's a real siren going off for most economists. All this debt is a cost that we are pushing on to the next generation of young Americans, one way or another. So even aside from what you think of the short-term economic effects may be of these annual deficits of $1 trillion we're running, these are costs which, in my view, are unfairly being pushed on to the next generation. So, politically, I think President Obama is doing, it looks like, with this and with the freezing of federal salaries a couple weeks ago, what President Clinton did in the mid-90s when he got a shellacking in 94. He moved to the center. He signed into a law, welfare reform and a telecom reform deal and other things with Republicans. And he is, of course, looked back now on as a president who had a very good centrist policies, and he's widely regarded as being a successful president. President Obama is clearly looking at the Clinton example, and hopefully, he continues to reach out to Republicans to find, some good, pro-growth economic policies in the years ahead.
Well, some call it moving to the center. Some have called it moving to the right. You may have your own thoughts. I'm talking to listeners now. In fact, if you'd like to weigh in here on this whole subject of the agreement that was reached, which some are calling a compromise, other a capitulation, what you think about it, let's hear from you. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, and we do welcome your phone calls. Again, you can join us whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite, and you can call us now at 866-733-6786 or send an email to forum@kqed.org or post a question or comment on our website simply by going to kqed.org, click on the forum and click on the segment. That's kqed.org/forum and click on the segment. Ari Berman, let me go back to the whole idea behind the tax cuts, particularly at this time with respect to how the Republicans are spinning it. They're saying that any kind of tax increase, and they're calling this a tax rate, really, would send the wrong message, particularly because we're in an economic downturn.
Well, that's been one of their messages. I mean, interestingly enough, the polls show over and over that voters don't want those tax cuts for the wealthy extended. So even though Republicans have been making that argument, voters don't seem to buy it. Now, Democrats have been trying to make the other argument, but they haven't been on the same page. So sort of in spite of the lack of a unified Democratic message, voters were still siding with what was the stated Democratic position on this. So I think the politics are somewhat dicey for Republicans, too. I mean, it's interesting, the Tea Party especially ran on this whole idea of cutting the deficit, but the first thing that they did, or the first thing that they're probably going to do when they get to Washington, is they're going to spend all this money that would otherwise perhaps have gone to cut the deficit. So it does seem like there's a fair amount of hypocrisy on the Republican side on this issue right now.
Dean Baker, can you break down the other reported details of this deal for us? It's supposed to include payroll tax reduction and a compromise on the estate tax and also a tax rate for capital gains and dividends to be essentially kept at 15%. How does that all play out in your mind?
Well, just very quickly, I wanted to clarify something Chris said. That this doesn't have borrowing today doesn't have to impose any burden whatsoever on our children, because there's no reason the Federal Reserve Board can't simply buy and hold the debt. And in fact, it's holding a lot of debt right now. So it refunded $77 billion of interest that was paid out last year by the Treasury. So this idea that this is creating this huge burden for our children, that's fanciful. That there's no reason it has to do that. But the other parts of the picture, it does have a tax break there where they're going to reduce temporarily the payroll tax for Social Security by 2 percentage points, and the trust fund is supposed to be credited with that money. So it shouldn't affect the Social Security trust fund at all. That's for 2 years, and that
replaces the making work pay tax credit that was basically $400 for the vast majority of wage earners. So for most people, that will mean more. For lower-income workers, that will mean somewhat less, a disadvantage in my view. The estate tax is lowered. You recall that we have no estate tax for 2010. It goes back to the 2000, the pre-President Bush levels for 2011. That's the current law. Under this deal, they zero out the first $5,000 of estates. That will exempt probably about 99.5%, the vast, vast majority of estates, maybe a little more than that. So very few people have more than $5 million. And then it lowers the rate. The current law is 45%. It lowers that to 35%. So that's a big cut in the estate tax from what would be either in the current law or even the proposal that President Obama had been pushing going back to the 2009 rates. The other part, it leaves in place the 15% tax rate on capital gains and dividends. Again, those would have gone back to their capital gains would have gone back above us to 20%. Dividends had previously been taxed as normal income. So for high-end earners, if we'd gone back to the pre-Bush rates, it would have been 39.6%.
Here's a listener named Mark from Modesto who writes, arguments that President Obama lacked the political will to insist on the expiration of the cuts to the top marginal tax rate missed the point. There was no way around a Republican filibuster in the Senate. Some suggest the president should have called the Republicans' bluff, letting all the cuts expire and pushing for the introduction of middle-class cuts in the next Congress. He would have been blocked by a filibuster then, too. Liberals calling for Obama's head should focus their energy on filibuster reform. What do you say to that, Ari Berman?
I think that is a good point. I mean, I think there needs to be a lot more focus on filibuster reform going forward. Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon has introduced a plan this week that I think is quite thoughtful and worth looking at. But I do think that Democrats and Obama specifically could have made this more of a PR issue, could have made this more of a winning issue, and really forced Republicans to vote on it. And I think if there had been a sustained push, if they had engaged in a PR war and over said, you know, Republicans are blocking middle-class tax cuts, we don't know what would have happened. So I think it's hard to prove, obviously, a counterfactual, but I also don't think that Obama really had much political will to have this fight, and so I don't think we really know how it would have played out if he had pushed the issue hard.
Well, we're getting a lot of emails like the following from Dave, who writes, Obama just gave away his second term. Arguing for tax increases during the 2012 campaign turns him into Walter Mondale. And Chris Edwards, here's Francis, who writes, I've been hearing a lot of misrepresentations of the Bush tax cut in the press. The law was written by Republicans to expire this year. They wrote the law to expire. The Democrats forced them to make the law, not bust the budget, and contribute too much to the deficit. That is why the Republicans wrote it to expire. I hear them say this is a tax increase. No, they wrote it as a temporary 10-year bonus program that was to expire this year. They claim then and they claim now that it would grow the economy based on the Laffer curve that the first Bush called voodoo economics. It did not grow the economy then, and it won't now. It was voodoo economics then, and it is voodoo economics now. And you say what, Chris Edwards?
the Bush tax cuts expired because of the particular procedural rules in the Senate made it very difficult for Republicans to put into law permanent tax cuts beyond the 10-year budget window without 60 votes. And so, frankly, it's very difficult to you can't get permanent tax cuts through the Senate unless you have 60 votes, basically. And so the Republicans wanted them to be permanent. They're just not able to. Here's the funny thing. I mean, I saw Senator Conrad on MSNBC last night, and he was talking about these tax cuts that are being extended. And he said he was with President Obama because he said the biggest percentage tax cut by signing this extension into law will go to lower income people. And I almost fell out of my chair because for years we've been hearing folks on the political left saying that all the Bush tax cuts went to the rich people, and it was unfair because they're biased to the rich people. And here's Senator Conrad on MSNBC last night admitting that the biggest tax cuts here from these cuts go to moderate income people, which is the reality.
Well, we're going to a break, and when we return, we'll hear more from our guests and from you, our listeners, joining us by phone as well as email and posting comments and questions on our website. Chris Edwards is with the Cato Institute. Dean Baker is with the Center for Economic and Policy Research. And Ari Berman is with The Nation magazine. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. President Obama and congressional Republicans apparently have reached an agreement yesterday on the Bush tax cuts, which were set to expire, are set to expire, actually, at the end of this year. We're discussing the details of that tentative deal. Of course, this has to go to Congress. We haven't heard yet from former Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and, well, actually, still presently, technically, this, well, she's still presently, technically, she's the lame duck speaker, I guess. Talking with Chris Edwards, who directs tax policy studies for the Cato Institute, Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research and author of Plunder and Blunder, The Rise and Fall of the Bubble Economy, and Ari Berman, contributing writer for The Nation magazine and author of Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. Before I go to your calls, let me go to some of your emails here. Sandy from Woodside writes, wasn't the president shellacking in the last election due to the demand for fiscal responsibility? Obama's base is angry, but what about those who voted for the Republicans in order to cut the deficit? This compromise will cost us $900 billion in just the next 2 years for a policy which has failed in the past. I absolutely am disgusted with our political leadership. I can only hope the congressional Democrats would just say no. My Obama sticker comes off today. I think it's actually $60 billion a year, Sandy, but Sandy's sentiments seem to dovetail with a lot of sentiments from different listeners. Frank writes, I've been a strong supporter of Obama's, but after seeing him roll over on every single issue from health care to tax cuts for the wealthy, I think he should resign. Joe Biden would know how to stand up to the Republicans. As a bonus, he would probably get us out of Afghanistan. And Antoine says, I'm a Democrat, and there's no way to spin this. I'm very disappointed in this decision. There is no reason for the top 2% to get any breaks. Rich people like making money and will grow their worth regardless of what tax breaks they receive. Unemployment benefits have to end at some point, so why not now? This makes no sense. And to correct your guess, the deficit was supposed to be the reason why we had this wave election that brought the Republicans into power. Where are they now? Couple more emails from listeners. Christopher writes, I really don't understand how anyone can possibly defend raising more taxes, a.k.a. repealing the tax cuts. If you add all the taxes we pay, federal income, state, sales taxes, property taxes, fuel taxes, etc., we're already paying over 50% of our income to the government. Rich or poor is not the issue. The issue is using the money we have wisely. If I can't afford something, I do without. In the greed and lust for power, politicians have promised much more than we can support. The more you raise taxes on the rich, the less money you actually make. And another listener weighs in here and says, nearly a decade of these tax cuts got us bubble-based growth and an anemic job market, but no sustainable growth. I understand the theoretical argument for tax cuts leading to growth, but why is it so rarely pointed out that empirical evidence throughout the history of our nation and other developed nations demonstrates tax cuts have a tenuous connection to economic growth at best? To see examples of tax cuts leading to growth, you have to look at examples where the top rate started at over 70%. Those situations bear no resemblance to our current tax structure. And that's from Devin. And let's get a response on that last one. Chris Edwards?
You know, Dean mentioned top tax rates in prior decades, too, and this is an important issue. People sometimes point out that for about three or four decades in the mid-20th century, our top income tax rate was 70%. But you know what? That was a very unproductive back then. It didn't make good economic sense back then, and what it did is it resulted in high-income people chiseling themselves out a lot of special loopholes and exemptions in the tax code. So they didn't pay the rate on the books was 70%. They ended up not really paying it. What has changed in the last few decades is that we've had what I call a global tax revolution. Tax rates have plunged around the world. Capital is mobile. Rich people, corporations can push their money offshore these days. The average top income tax rate amongst the 30 industrial countries now is about 42%. If you put our state and local taxes on top of our federal rate, we're currently at about 42%. So we're not a low tax country anymore because there's been a general move towards lowering tax rate because other countries like Canada, Australia have recognized that high rates, you know, you shoot yourself in the foot in a global economy.
Chris, I have to ask you, you're Canadian, aren't you?
I sure am.
I could tell by the about. Dean Baker, let's hear from you on this.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not accurate to say we're not a low-tax country. Our total tax takes a little over 30% of GDP. If you look at Europe, you have several countries that are 50% or even a little bit higher. So we still are way below the average for the other wealthy countries. And, you know, if we make the comparisons in terms of growth, we had tax rates of over 90% on the top bracket until Kennedy lowered them in the early 60s. So it wasn't just 70, it was 90%. And sure, there was a lot of evasion. But the reality was we had very rapid growth during those periods. So if you look at the growth rate and, you know, you contrast this period of the tax revolution, as Chris calls it, to the period before the tax revolution, we in fact had much more rapid growth, not just U.S. You know, all the other countries that were pre-tax revolution, they also had more rapid growth. Now, I'm not going to say there's causation there, but you're a little hard-pressed. Here it is. We all did what Chris wanted us to. We lowered our tax rates. We gave our rich people a break, and we had less growth, and we had bubbles. So, again, I'm not going to say that that's causation. It's a little more complicated than that, but you're a little hard-pressed to look at the history and go, oh, my God, if you have high tax rates, you don't have growth, because, in fact, we had much more rapid growth when we had those high tax rates.
All right, Berman, let's hear from you.
Well, I think some of those emails were instructive. I think Obama's obviously getting pulled in two directions. He's getting pulled in the compromise direction from Republicans. I think from his own reading of the election, he said after the election that he appeared too much like a tax and spend Democrat. So obviously he didn't want to have any sort of tax increase if that's the message he's reading. But I think he's also getting pushed in another direction from his base, from Democrats, from the Obama coalition, broadly speaking, which is that he has not been fighting hard enough for what he believes in, that he has not been principled enough. He's not been pursuing the policies that he really ran on. And I think it's hard to square that. And so I think going forward, clearly Obama is going to compromise, but I think they have to ask themselves, okay, well, what's the substance of the compromise? How will it play with our supporters? And at what point do we reach a breaking point where people say, okay, enough is enough. We're really angry and we want something else in return. So I think if he just makes these deals, if he just does a freeze on federal workers, if he just does more and more things to move to the right and does nothing for his coalition, for his base, I think he's going to be in some real political trouble in 2012.
And that would include perhaps the Star Treaty and Guantanamo and Don't Ask, Don't Tell, just really going up and down the line?
Yeah, I mean, I think Don't Ask, Don't Tell is really the critical one. I don't think people are that invested in the START Treaty, quite frankly. I think it's a bit of an afterthought. But yeah, I mean, there's Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Well, but what we're calling compromise here, certainly in many people's minds, particularly those who are feeling disaffected, and we'll hear from one of those listeners in just a moment, are saying it's like a potential house of cards for him, especially once the lame duck Congress is gone.
Well, he's going to have a lot less room to maneuver because even though that they will lose the House, he still has the presidency, they still have the Senate, so there's still a lot that he could potentially do, especially with the executive branch, if he wanted to use the authority that he has.
All right, but let me go to David here. And David, join us, please, on Forum. Welcome.
Hi. Basically, everything that I would have had to say has been said, but bottom line, he's not the president that I voted for, and I won't be tricked again. This is the last compromise. He caved on health legislation. His administration has been defending many of the Bush administration's civil rights violations, such as wiretap. Evidently, he believes in the trickle-down theory. The allegation that he's a socialist is so absurd. No strings attached to the bailout. Where has he been in leadership? Either he's just a failed leader or he misrepresented who he was. And I've been a lifelong Democrat. I will not support him.
Okay. I thank you for going on record with that. And we're hearing a lot of that, Ari Berman.
Well, those are obviously strong words. And I think that sentiment is particularly high today with the news of the deal. I think that clearly, this is a political problem for Obama that he's going to have to deal with a lot of these disaffected supporters. I do think that over time, we'll see how it plays out. I mean, if Barack Obama's running against Sarah Palin, for example, in 2012, some of those disaffected supporters may come back into the tent. But there's no doubt that the administration, they can't just ignore these people. They can't just pretend like they don't exist. This is a constituency that's really aggrieved, and they have to start listening to their concerns.
And we'll go to more of your calls. Olas, good morning.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Welcome.
It seems to me that the rhetoric in terms of the deficit has been inconsistent in the sense that the gentleman earlier was applauding President Obama for finding this agreement with the Republicans and that this would somehow lead to deficit reduction. I think if the Republicans were really interested in deficit reduction and if it was really a calamity, that they would be pursuing all means to reduce the deficit, both reduce spending and allowing at least some of these tax increases, or rather tax breaks, to go away. And I think that's consistent what more with their past behavior, the incredible deficit run-ups under both Reagan and second Bush. And I'll take your response off.
Okay, let's hear from you on that, Dean Baker.
Well, you know, just as an empirical matter, the Republicans have not been the party that's been associated with deficit reduction. You had President Reagan came in office with a relatively modest deficit. It was expanded somewhat by the recession, but even with that, it was relatively modest. He had tax cuts along with his military buildup, and we suddenly had very large deficits. At that point, the largest in the post-war period. George Bush the first did take some steps to bring those down, but they were still quite large when President Clinton came in office. And President Clinton, better or worse, I wasn't actually fond of it, but he did get the deficit down, and we actually got a surplus. Some of that was due to the stock bubble, but nonetheless, he left office with a $240 billion surplus. And then we got President Bush, and he had large tax cuts, and he had the military buildup associated with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And again, we end up with very large deficits. So just as a practical matter, you're a little hard-pressed to see the Republicans as the party of low deficits and fiscal responsibility. They have not been.
And here's Peter joining us. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning. You know, there's two discussions that I hear. One's about the politics. Which direction is Obama going? Is he compromising too much, not enough? You know, that to me is secondary. I mean, the people who certainly put Obama in office aren't very happy with what he's doing in terms of a compromise, so I don't see it helping his reelection effects. But really the question is public policy, and what's the best public policy? And from an economic standpoint, clearly the U.S. needs to do two things, raise revenue and cut spending. And this particular compromise certainly does neither of those. And I can't understand for the life of me how people making over $250,000 or making over $1 million a year cannot afford to help us with the revenue generation part, because that is a serious problem.
Well, Peter, I think you've outlined it very well. There is a kind of bifurcation in this discussion, which I'm glad about, because I think that both the political and the economic have to be considered. And let me just read a few more emails here that address the political. Sandy from San Carlos says, Michael, your guest just mentioned the old saw that Obama has now moved to the center. It's a great line for loyal Republicans, but it's just factually wrong. Every survey done in the past 6 months shows that a majority of voters don't want the tax cuts extended. So how is caving to the intransigent GOP moving to the middle? I'll answer my own question. It's not. It's caving again. And yet another listener says, I don't understand what your Democratic commentators expect of President Obama. How could he possibly have extended the cuts for just the middle class, etc.? He just doesn't have the votes for it in the Senate. I don't like Obama's policies because I think he's way left on economic policy, but it's kind of sad to see that he's being beaten up by his own party for stuff he can't do anything about. And here's Gerald, who says, what galls many Americans on the tax cuts for the rich is that we are again rewarding the many of the same people, rich bankers in Wall Street, who got us into this recession, depression in the first place. Where is the justice in this? And I just wanted to make a footnote that I noticed that in the event that the tax cuts were not extended, Wall Street had already made it clear that they were going to give big bonuses before they've expired. That's a matter of public record. Here's Steve Chris Edwards, who says, Chris Edwards' attempt to claim that this is not borrowing from our children is a clever rejoinder, but he knows it's not true. Or if it is true, then why should we care about any other borrowing we do? And another listener, Chris Edwards, says, if your guest from the Cato Institute wants to keep claiming that Obama's wild spending is not working, ask him, A, why he didn't say anything about Bush's wild spending, and B, how well Bush's unfunded tax cuts worked over the past 10 years when it came to holding down the deficit or creating jobs.
I'm glad that caller raised that, and Dean and a prior caller talked about, you know, how Republicans have been very inconsistent in their fiscal policy, and I absolutely agree. President Bush was the biggest spender, according to my calculation, since Lyndon Johnson in the 1960s. He spent big on defense. He spent big on domestic policies. He added a completely unfunded prescription drug benefit. So President Bush, like Richard Nixon, was a big spending Republican. And so I think that Republicans, absolutely, if they want tax cuts, they have the responsibility to match it with spending cuts so the deficit doesn't increase. And I hope the Republicans follow through with their rhetoric next year They promised substantial spending cuts. I hope they follow through with it, and it'll be interesting to see how President Obama deals with a hopefully resurgent Republicans in the House who do want to cut spending. But I agree. Look, I think that caller pegged me wrong. I do believe that debt is pushed onto our children, which I think is immoral, and it's bad economic policy. And very simply, the way to think about that is, let's say half of our borrowing comes from abroad these days, from bondholders in China and elsewhere. It means that down the road we're going to be producing GDP, but some share of that GDP, you know, 5 or 10% or something, is going to essentially be sliced off and handed to these bondholders, so our standard of living will be lower. More and more of our output will be going to foreign bondholders, and that lowers our standard of living. So debt is not a good thing.
Well, speaking about slicing, Chris Edwards, and debt. I wonder if you agree with a listener named David who says, since tax increases are off the table, the only way to bring the budget into balance is to cut spending, and he says spending is equal to entitlements, Social Security, Medicare, and so forth.
I think you need to cut spending across the board, and that's why I think Obama's fiscal commission, which included cuts to defense, cuts to domestic programs and entitlements, is a great idea. I think some of these conservative Republicans that won't touch defense, frankly, are going to be hopefully on the defensive next year, because I think a lot of these new Tea Party Republicans, like Senator Rand Paul, are talking about defense cuts. And so I hope President Obama can work with some of these more libertarian Republicans and cut the defense budget.
And we go to more of your calls. Gregory, join us. You're on the air on Forum. Thank you for waiting.
Good morning. I just wanted to say, you know, I'm in that, you know, higher tax bracket, and, you know, if I thought it would solve the problem by paying higher taxes, I would do it, but it's not the issue. The issue is, you know, all the waste, all the poor management, and when Obama was elected, you know, I voted for him, and he said he's going to go line by line and fix a lot of this overspending, and I haven't heard a word about it, and to me, it's just, you know, a matter of management. It's not a matter of money.
Since you've called in, it reminds me, Gregory, of the fact that there are a number of patriotic millionaires who, like Warren Buffett, who have come out and said we need essentially not to have these tax cuts for the very, very rich. You're pretty much joining with them then, I assume.
Yeah,
I think it's a matter of patriotism, really.
I think patriotism isn't the problem. I think, you know, saying that it's not morally right to push it off to our kids, you're right, it's not. But it's not also morally right to people who have worked hard. Not everybody just sat behind a desk and, you know, got a big fat check. I mean, a lot of people have worked really hard to, you know, obtain their wealth. And, you know, if it could fix the problem, you know, we'd all throw our money at it. But that's not the problem. The problem is poor management and the waste. And, you know, it's just one story after another about all these Medicare fraud things where, you know, five people racked up, you know, bills for millions of dollars. You know, it's just the system needs to be, you know, revamped.
Okay. I thank you for those sentiments and thoughts. And we'll go to another caller right off. Matt, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thank you, Mr. Krasny, for the discussion. I just, as a 26-year-old infuriated Democrat, I cannot wrap my head around the correlation between those at the realms of the banking industry as well as Wall Street, and how they the middle class, the tax base, pretty much bail them out and save their behinds, and yet now it seems like there's just a complete unwilling compensation, accommodation from those making over $250,000. I mean, my question, I guess, to you and your guests is why don't the Democrats, why don't they just, they shove this rhetoric down our throat? You know, why isn't it made more clear? I mean, they just seem very timid in their stance and in the rhetoric. I mean, it's just a complete hostage takeover by the GOP. It's so infuriating.
Well, Ari Berman, I think there's a salient question there. I mean, why aren't the Democrats tougher on Wall Street and the bankers and so forth? Yeah.
No, and they've really been somewhat schizophrenic on this, especially the president. I mean, one day he's lambasting fat cat bankers, and the other hand, he's saying, well, he doesn't begrudge multi-million dollar salaries and bonuses. And so I think they haven't really figured out their positioning on that. A number of Democrats supported the bailout, for example, and so they've been in a tough place to push this kind of populism. I do think, as I said earlier, that they missed an opportunity during the election to really make the tax issue an election issue and basically say Democrats are for the middle class, Republicans are for the rich, and really contrast that strongly, and they didn't really do that. Instead, the differences are going to blur, and in 2012, I don't see how Obama can argue his case that effectively if he just supported tax cuts for the rich, because essentially he's supporting now a policy that he claims to oppose, which puts him in an odd position when he has to campaign on it.
You know, there's a very elephant-in-the-room question in all this, and I'll ask you your thoughts about this, Ari Berman, on the political front, and it's a question that I haven't seen surface, really, and it has to do with President Obama's executive leadership abilities or his abilities to follow through. I mean, by elephant in the room, obviously, I'm not talking about the GOP. This is someone who had really no experience in the executive realm at all, who was seen by the public as what he is, very bright and decent man, and who inspired a great deal of hope and all, but was essentially a community organizer who was in legislatures for a pretty short period of time. So executive experience is simply not there. And often we hear of executives who are effective with Congress by essentially providing, well, you think about LBJ, for example, whipping Congress into shape and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, that is a good point. And the fact is, no one knew exactly how his lack of experience would translate in terms of running the government. And it hasn't translated that well. I think one of the mistakes he made, though, is I think he somewhat overlearned the lessons of the Clinton and Carter years, where they brought in, because they were also viewed as inexperienced people, they brought in a lot of new people, and they were viewed as not that skillful in negotiating with Capitol Hill. So Obama did the opposite. He brought in a lot of legislative insiders, people like Rahm Emanuel, and really deferred to them in terms of how he ran the government. And I think he became, instead of a guy representing change, representing new blood, he became much more a conventional business-as-usual leader. And I think that really has undermined his unique grassroots outside the Beltway brand. And he's really faded into the background of these discussions. He doesn't, his sort of leadership qualities aside, he doesn't really seem like he is the leader necessarily who's negotiating the terms of the debate. It really seems like, for example, Republicans in Congress are more in control than the President of the United States.
Frankly, a lot of leadership came from the Congresswoman from San Francisco. I mean, if you're going to
I mean, and that's the reason why a lot of Democrats wanted Nancy Pelosi to stay, because she was someone who they viewed with having backbone in fighting for what she believed in, and they didn't see that coming from Harry Reid. They didn't see it coming from Barack Obama.
Here's another comment on the political front from a listener named Paul, who says the current deal on tax cuts and unemployment is the inevitable result of the Democrats' choice in October to delay action on the tax cuts. They decided to postpone a vote on tax cuts in October so as not to interrupt their fundraising from big business and wealthy donors. The Democrats would have won votes in November if they had forced Republicans to filibuster this in October. And here we have, and Dean Baker, this is to you because you were saying earlier that you felt that these tax cuts will at least redound back to the economy and will be a stimulus. And a listener asks, is the idea that tax cuts for the top earner benefiting the economy, does that have any factual base or is it solely an ideological base?
No, look, I'm not a fan of giving more money to the people who have the most, but the fact is they will spend it. And this really is kind of straightforward. We need demand in the economy right now. The reason why we have 25 million people unemployed or underemployed is there is no demand. And this is President Obama. This is what I get mad at more than anything else. He never explained that simple story. We had demand being created by the housing bubble. That disappeared when the bubble burst. We have to replace that. And if you give money to rich people, they'll spend some of it. Not as much as poor people, but they'll spend some of it. Let me just quickly correct the point that Chris had made. There's a lot of confusion about this issue of borrowing from China. We borrow from China because we have a trade deficit. That's due to the fact that the dollar is overvalued. It makes goods from China very cheap in the United States, so people go and buy the goods from China at Walmart rather than domestically produced goods. So if we're concerned about borrowing from abroad, we should be upset about the overvalued dollar and the trade deficit. Nothing to do with the budget deficit. So that's totally misleading. And one last point on that. Every projection I know shows that 20, 30 years out, people will on average be much wealthier than they are today. So when we talk about our children or grandchildren, there's almost no scenario you could think of, short of environmental disaster or nuclear war, that they're not going to be much wealthier on average than people are today. Now, there is an issue about distribution. If everything keeps going to those at the top, then there'll be an intra-generational issue where, you know, Bill Gates' children and grandchildren may have everything. But they will be much richer on average than we are today.
Let me get Bruce on next. Bruce, you're on.
Hi, this is not a day of journalistic accomplishment. I'm waiting to hear from your panel. I'm waiting to hear from you, Michael, also. Some reality in this discussion. You're happy for the duality of the discussion, politics and reality, but the focus has been on politics, and it's been a negative downward discussion. This is a two-party system, and why would I have to remind you folks as political pundits that this is a two-party system? The reason why the president has made abundantly clear that he's opposed to this increase deficit vote, but he had no other choice. It really is disturbing to me that the so-called supporters of Obama are so willing to throw him under the bus at this point, to take off their bumper stickers. That's really silly. It's just such a silly response. When you think, and I've not heard your discussion on his accomplishments, health care, we're out of Iraq, federal regulations, the stimulus saved us. We are now have movement so that people can go into Christmas not worrying about maybe whether or not they can eat, so unemployment's taken care of, women's rights are being looked at, don't ask, don't tell, we're making movement on that. And yet you, Michael, keep repeating the same mantra. Really what you just did is what that guy from the Dodgers did when he said that black managers don't have the necessities. That's the message you're putting out there. This administration has accomplished more than the last administrations have ever accomplished. That's recognized, it's noted. And the guy from Cato, the thing that makes me so annoyed with these discussions is that you don't really care about the issues. You care about the politics. And that keeps your salaries going.
Okay, so I think we're out of time. I'm glad he got on the air, and we'll let it stand, which is difficult for me to do, by the way. But let me thank all of you, Chris Edwards from the Cato Institute, Dean Baker from the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and Ari Berman from Nation Magazine. Appreciate you all being with
thank
us.
You.
Appreciate you, our listeners, being with us. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And an hour ahead, we're going to talk about kids and emotions in the hour ahead. Decidedly shift gears. Hope you will join us for that. Thank you for joining us for this. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers are Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. And Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.